therein for me lies the rub, really, in really the emotional tax of wanting to blend chameleon-like into society, but fighting a corner and a cause for all, you know, intersectionalities of diversity and inclusion, but then one not wanting to be abrasive in doing so. And it's sort of like, how do we affect change if we're being kind of leaning in with kind eyes on one hand and then being slightly revolutionary on the other? And it's for me an eternal kind of struggle, both, you know, personally and in my professional life.
Hello, and welcome to Design Meets Insight, Heta Architects podcast, where we share some of the fascinating and inspiring conversations we're having with thinkers and creators in and around the world of architecture and design. I'm your host, Namrata Krishna. I'm a design strategy lead at Heta, and for this episode, my co-host is the wonderful Nikki Whiteman, who is the head of emerging trends at global real estate business Savills. For this episode on power in public spaces, we're joined by Pippa Catterall and Adam Bray. Pippa is professor of history and policy at the University of Westminster, editor of National Identities, and chair of AIDS Memory UK. Reflecting her role as a member of Westminster's Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion Committee, her recent research focuses upon the relationship between inclusivity and public space. Adam is a director at Savills and heads up the place shaping team within London, helping deliver programs of cultural activity at sites across the capital, including King's Cross, London Bridge City, and the Leadenhall Building. He's particularly active in areas of diversity and inclusion and community engagement, with an interest in how this translates into business environments. Our conversation with Pippa and Adam touched on quite a few topics that we've discussed in previous episodes, while also really offering new perspectives and ways of thinking about public space. Nikki, could you tell us a bit more about why you wanted the two of them to come on the podcast?
Yeah, so Namrata, we've talked about over the last few episodes, I think, how you think about designing public spaces that are engaging and resonate with a wide variety of people. I'm conscious that we always talk, I think, about these ideas of places being destinational and experiential. But for me, there's something, I suppose, more fundamental about this conversation, the idea of who has power in space, and how do we think about making places which are genuinely inclusive, which are safe, which feel welcoming, and how do we all feel more empowered? So that's what we're going to talk about in this episode.
If you look at women passing through public spaces are usually spaces for male gazes rather than for female gazes. So, one of the things you notice is how often you end up jumping out of the way of men who are walking straight at you. There's actually an experiment by a group of journalists in New York a few years ago where they tried not jumping out of the way for a week, and they all ended up with bruises, particularly the African-Americans and Latino ones. Surprise, surprise. So there's a degree of intersectionality as well in terms of how public space is made hierarchical.
So Pippa, tell us a bit more about how space has traditionally been designed to be hierarchical.
In some ways, I suppose you can do this by designing buildings to express authority. So if you think about it, historically, you use columns. Stick a column with an Ionic capital or a Corinthian capital on it, and it screams authority. And that can be a way of discouraging people from entering the building in the first place, both people you don't want to be in the building because they might be causing trouble, but also people you do want to be in the building. So one of the, in other words, how you design a space can create what we might term threshold fear, that this space is not for me. And one of the things you want to do is try and get away from that and say, actually, this space is not just for you, but it's for everyone. And everyone should feel safe here. And that becomes about how do you design spaces to achieve that kind of thing?
I completely agree with the concept of threshold fear. And I think it's a two-way boundary, because actually we've seen large-scale placemaking at the heart of developments come up across the country. And actually, does that create sort of a them and us mentality whereby you get a very much, you know, grassroots community that have been there for decades being suddenly pushed out for, you know, premium housing units? And in turn, that creates a sort of boundary whereby an estate, a newly formed estate, a reinvigorated estate, might become somewhere where the local community feels they can't set foot. Now, I think an example of a place that successfully integrated and continues to do so is Stratford and the, you know, Olympic Regeneration Project, because there wasn't just whole-scale redevelopment. The Olympic Delivery Authority really took on board, integrated with, and continued to work alongside the local community to ensure that there was job value creation, apprenticeships, training, obviously, you know, local community engagement activities, etc. So that really has been wholesale, and developments like Here East continue to be part of the evolutionary journey. And I think we had the benefit of looking back at, you know, previous Olympics and understanding how other cities across Europe have suffered, Athens being one notable. But I think with regards the permeability of these spaces, it's the sort of the bits in between. When you step off, let's say, a campus, you can feel like you're stepping off the edge of a cliff into a kind of 1980s version of London. And so how do you manage, I think Pippa and I have spoken in the past about the transition spaces, the liminal spaces into a space where you might not necessarily feel comfortable. So surveillance can be both a boon and a curse, because actually that security and provision of security can be accretive to the overall experience of a place.
So, Adam, given all your experience and your role in the place team, tell us a little bit about your views, your ideas on how we successfully create places and make people feel genuinely included.
Without sort of sounding too buzz phrasey, there are three things that for me, because obviously we're talking macro trends in terms of intersectionality, diversity, inclusion within both workspace and public discourse, and how that influences and really how place influences behavior. For me, it's three things: spaces, voices, and resources. By spaces, it's how we can design spaces that are flexible for both business, private, and community use. Voices, a fundamental aspect of, I feel, successful organic places are ones that have been developers that listen to and interpret and understand and involve community voices, be it skateboarders, be it the local residential community, be it key stakeholders within that area. And then resources, this is for me the final kind of hurdle, because you can design amazing spaces and you can give voice to the community and have an active feedback loop. But often what happens is through service charge budgets, through value engineering, you'll get suddenly years 1 to 3 with great healthy budgets falling off the edge of a cliff, and overnight, investors, venture capitalists who might buy out a scheme say, right, that's kind of nice to have, but not essential. So your budget, thank you very much, is going to be slashed overnight. It is fundamental that, you know, there is sufficient budget and resource to provide community groups with the space and the time and the money they need in order to keep those spaces alive.
And what does that mean for the kind of diversity we need within the design industry, you know, within the teams who are actually designing our public spaces?
You want to do a kind of impact assessment, inclusivity impact assessment, for instance, then you need to be able to understand what inclusivity means, not just for you. And so many designers are cis white men, straight men, who don't necessarily understand the extent to which they may build into their approach to public space the privilege which they can that goes with that status. you're not going to be doing an entirely effective impact inclusivity impact assessment. So there is a need to think through what assumptions you're carrying when you go into these kinds of processes.
So, Pippa, there are some really good international examples of how you do inclusivity well. I'm thinking here of Vienna and the work that's been done in terms of spaces that are good for women. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
What you're referring to is the developments in Vienna, which are called Frauenwerkstatt, the Women Work City, and particularly around the suburb of Aspern in Vienna. And we can see this attempt at what's called gender mainstreaming also in operation in Stockholm, in the suburb of Husby. And in both of these places, what they've tried to do is address the different ways in which women use space. So we know, for instance, that historically men have been more likely to commute than women, that it's still the case that generally speaking women do more journeys, shorter journeys, women have the bulk of childcare responsibilities, etc., etc. But these differences, these gender differences, have not necessarily been taken into account in how public space has been designed. So the question of thinking through those processes, thinking about where you place schools in relationships to residential developments so as to make those journeys relatively easy. In Vienna, they've tried to design these spaces so that you've taken into account in the design, both of the open spaces and of the residential buildings, things like use of prams, the height, so because women tend to be shorter, so you've taken into account gender data gaps in how things have been designed. And all of that has been built in. They've also had entirely female teams designing some of the spaces in order to make sure that important perspectives on, from a female point of view are not missed. I think that's been, generally speaking, pretty successful in addressing some of these issues. And you could argue that diversity in thinking about these things not only gives you a range of perspectives, so you can go, okay, well, what might be a problem with us doing this? But diversity is also good because it gives you more ideas, because you're bringing a greater range of experience and cultural perspectives to a process of problem solving. And all evidence suggests that that's generally a good thing.
So how about when there are existing communities that, you know, may feel resentful or distrustful around change? How can we then approach designing spaces that signal inclusivity there?
If you can create spaces where everyone gets something from it, where you use that Section 106 agreement or whatever to create something for the existing community, and something which is a bit more useful than a kind of sticking plaster approach of let's put a swing in or something like that, then I think it's going to be more effective in dealing with those low-level resentments. Adam?
I think just to add to your point, Pippa, place as a concept or placemaking as a concept is for me kind of can feel really trite and hackneyed, and sticking in something that's visible has become something of a tick box exercise. So it's so really interesting and refreshing to hear that. For me, really, it's understanding that places do carry like an emotional kind of tax or burden to certain sections of society. And so how can that be interpreted through the built environment? And really, the answer is it's really a combination of factors from both the physical and the social. But I'll use an example of Regent's Place as a sort of development that has sprung up and become a leader in its field when it comes to community and customer engagement. The people use it daily, and then the wider community. It's quite a sort of a stark, business-like development. Yet they've got something called queer care, which is for the LGBTQ plus community who might be vulnerable, who might need support. There's a drop-in center there. They've just hosted an exhibition of LGBTQ plus art called Loudest Whispers. And it's, really providing those moments of cultural interventions that I would say normalize, but actually Pippa would use usualize, which I really like, which is usualizing the experience of gay life in London for people who might not experience it. They might not be prejudiced. They're just not exposed to it so much. So putting these experiences, these cultural interventions into places where there is mainstream footfall actually becomes part of the cultural fabric of London, of our city and further afield. And what you then get is that sense of, I don't want to use the word exposure, but it's that experience and learning through experience. And then what you get is a sort of lean-in mentality. And when you get that lean-in mentality, it's about us supporting one another as marginal groups. And that becomes a collective voice, which then becomes a very attractive place for the rest of society to come and experience.
I think to achieve the kinds of things that Adam's talking about, you need spaces in which diversity is encoded, not just so that people can see their own diversities reflected in these things, but also so that, if you like, mainstream or people who see themselves as being more normative within society rather than those of us who fall into one of these more marginalized categories don't feel that somehow they're losing their position within society as well. So, it's fine. It's great to have exhibitions which celebrate queer art or whatever. But it's also important that you have this included in other exhibitions. That's one of the ways in which you usualize. And you go, actually, this is just one of the ways in which people are human. And to some extent, I think you do need those kind of specialized support systems. But I think you also need to be making sure that you don't create resentments by bending over backwards to give support to previously marginalized groups as well, because it's almost like a way of encouraging targeting.
Therein, for me, lies the rub, really, in really the emotional tax of wanting to blend chameleon-like into society, but fighting a corner and a cause for all, intersectionalities of diversity and inclusion, but then one not wanting to be abrasive in doing so. And it's sort of like, how do we affect change if we're being kind of leaning in with kind eyes on one hand and then being slightly revolutionary on the other? And it's for me an eternal kind of struggle, both, personally and in my professional life. And I don't have the answer.
Yeah, it's a really big conversation. And there are some really important challenges. I think it's important to talk about this.
And Adam, for certain neighborhoods then, like gayborhoods that have grown around or for particular communities, it seems like there's then a conflict around them becoming attractive to developers.
And therein lies, again, the crux, because you get the formation of a community that is marginalized by its own visibility. And that's sort of a very strange concept. And the same happened in Kemp Town in Brighton, which is now, one of the most expensive places to live on the south coast of England. So you could argue artists have the same experience. They go to where it's cheap. They do up a place. They create trends. They create vibrancy and atmosphere. And then the developers move in. So, I'm in real estate. My clients are developers. They're visionary. But at the same time, are we in turn kind of creating too much or putting too much demand on authenticity and trying to replicate that authenticity, and in turn squeezing out the communities who create that in the first place.
Or perhaps overdeveloping some of these spaces and in the process removing some of the organic nature of these spaces. And you know, so there are issues about there's been issues in London, for instance, in recent times about building into planning processes protection for properties such as the Royal Vauxhall Tavern to prevent the removal of those community amenities.
So I have one final question, which is really around, you know, why this topic is important to you personally. You know, what's your connection to it?
It's important to me because I'm human. I'm a member of the public too. And I traverse these spaces. And I am conscious that, I mean, I suppose it's double-edged. On one level, I would like to see more desistance of bad behaviour. And whilst I think design is not the only way to do that, I think good design can certainly help to reduce misogynistic violence or hate crimes of any kind. But more positively, this can be a way of making people feel more at home, more willing to accept diversity within society, so, which goes beyond when we're in public spaces, to create a society which is actually more cohesive, because we're recognising in the public realm that we are all collectively the public, rather than some people being more part of the public than others. I mean, one way in which we could have talked about that, but we haven't really, is the way in which you signal inclusivity through monuments in public space. So the lack of monuments to women, the lack of monuments to LGBTQ people in public space, the very few monuments to anyone who's not white. And I mean, one in Gravesend springs to mind, that kind of thing. But so all of those things are ways in which you can utilise public space, which when you get out of public space, you can also continue to embed in the way in which you think about things. I mean, Adam referred earlier to what we might call contact theory. The more you know of other people, the less you're scared of them. And so if you make public spaces ones where you're not just passing them in the street, but you're actually having to engage visually with difference and accept it as just part of the public realm, the more you can create a society in which everyone can be valued.
That was episode 5 of Design Meets Insight. A big thank you to our guests, Pippa Catterall and Adam Bray, and to Nikki Whiteman from Savills for bringing us all together. Feel free to get in touch via LinkedIn or email. Nikki and I would really love to hear from you and hear what you thought of the episode.